tolerate that ignition noise. Same thing with Arecibo, I mean with the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia. It's a radio quiet zone. There is no ham radio repeaters. There are no broadcast transmitters within a large number of miles of either of these locations. They are radio quiet zones. I think there isn't, I'm not sure whether or not there's even a cable television system in operation in Green Bank, West Virginia. It's a very, as you drive over the mountains to get into Green Bank, West Virginia, you slowly recognize that every one of the radio broadcast stations you listen to on your car radio slowly fade out as you go into that valley because they're not allowed to be operational very close nearby. And you suddenly realize that you're out of radio contact. And whether or not a cell phone works there, I'm not sure. I think there's very little cable TV. There's very little normal entertainment. Over-the-air broadcast doesn't exist in that particular area. So it's radio silence they're talking about. You could use a kind of a blanking circuit. Let me drop. And ham radio operators need a blanking circuit, particularly if you're back in the days of 432 megacycle ham radio of 1970, where the great big radar called an FPS-35 radar system was operational out at Montauk Point, Long Island. That was a really potent radar. And it was when it was on the air, it gave you some extremely strong pulses into your ham radio equipment, 120 decibels or 110 decibels above my noise threshold. I could disconnect the antenna from my equipment, and the pulses coming out of that radar went through the 70 miles between Montauk Point and my house in Huntington, went through the trees and hills and earth curvature and everything else, and enough of that signal got picked up by the power supply wiring of my 452 converter, and I would hear those pulses coming out of the receiver. That radar was that strong with when the antenna was disconnected right at the 432 converter. When I used the right kind of a ham radio blanker that was in a Drake R4 receiver, or the blanker that's in a Kenwood 520 receiver, which is almost as good, all of those small number of pulses per second would be completely eliminated. So there are kinds of noise blanker circuits as long as you have a small number of pulses per second. But when you use a noise blanker on a radio telescope, you do affect the accuracy of the measurement they're making. They're trying to measure the amount of radio noise at various frequencies, at various polarization angles that are coming from that particular star. The amount of radio noise coming out of that star tells you a lot of information about how big is the star, how hot is the star, what is it made out of, is there a local magnetic field. You make enough polarimetry measurements of amplitude versus frequency and polarization, you get a lot of information about that radio star. And that's the kind of measurements they're making, as I see it, Alan.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
And you'd be amazed how many ham radio operators have set up a radio telescope. When you're setting up your equipment to do real good ham radio moon bounce communication on 2 meters and 432 and 1296 and so on, you really are building a radio telescope. In fact, almost all of those guys will measure the quality of their moon bounce equipment by periodically aiming it at the sun and measuring the amount of sun noise that comes into that receiver. And by making a measurement with the antenna aimed at the sun or aimed at cold sky, by sweeping back and forth between cold sky and hot sun, so to speak, and looking at the noise change, you can now measure the quality of your antenna and low noise amplifier. It's called gain to temperature ratio measurement, and it's a way of qualifying the performance of your telescope system, of your moonbound system. And so to some degree, every moonbound ham radio setup really is a radio telescope. And some of those guys get hooked by the radio astronomy measurements, and they start measuring the noise power coming out of various stars that they can aim the antenna at. KC2, Oscar Lima Bravo, K2RIW. Go ahead, Alan. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
KC2, Oscar Lima Bravo. Yeah, thanks a lot for all the info. I wasn't too sure. I knew that it had to be an RF quiet zone, but they, you know, the sign that they had, you know, approaching the driveway didn't explicitly say that it was supposed to be RF quiet. They said quiet. So So I was just guessing, you know, maybe acoustic noise would, you know, mess up with any of the equipment. But go ahead. Thanks for all the extra info, too, because I had no idea that you can actually use your moon bounce equipment can double as a radio telescope as well.
When you're driving on that road up to the Arecibo Radio Telescope in Puerto Rico, and they tell you to, this is a quiet zone, you should then start whispering when you talk to your wife in the car, and you should whisper to your children, I'm having fun with you, Steve. I mean, Alan. No, acoustic, with rare exception, a radio telescope is almost always used for making radio measurements, not acoustic measurements. And even if you got near that dish and you shouted as loud as you could and you beat the horn on your car and you took out your compressed air horn device and you made a whole lot of acoustic noise, that would not be affecting their radio measurements. But the ignition system in your car, if it happened to be a noisy radio ignition system, that could give them some grief. And so they would like you to not use a non-diesel vehicle when you're on their property. At least that's true at the NRAO, National Radio Astronomy Observatory, in Greenback, West Virginia. They want you to drive into their parking lot, park your car, and pick up one of their bicycles. At each one of their buildings, stacked out in front, are usually a number of bicycles. And you pick up one of those bicycles and you move from building to building to the chow down hall or the residence center or the library or the main auditorium and whatever at the Greenbank, West Virginia. You go all between all those places with a bicycle, and you're supposed to choose the American fixed speed bicycles. And if you decide that, hey, there's a real nice English bicycle with 18 speeds, I'm going to choose that one. Well, I've made that mistake on a couple of occasions, and I was choosing somebody's private property. You're supposed to know the difference between the general public bicycles versus the private property bicycles. That particular person hadn't put a lock on it, and I chose the wrong bicycle one day, and in a friendly manner, the guy let me know about it. And you want to see a real good radio telescope, take a look at...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The biggest fully steerable radio telescope, to my knowledge, on planet Earth, is the 100-meter diameter, which is 310 feet in diameter, which is, is that more than an acre? Yeah. That fully steerable radio telescope at Greenbank, West Virginia. I was there during its construction, and if you simply Google the word, what do they call it now? The Great Big Telescope, the Greenbank Telescope, and it's got somebody's name associated with it, a famous person in West Virginia is now associated. But you just Google the words National Radio Astronomy Observatory and telescope, I guarantee you're going to find this 100-meter fully steerable telescope. And under normal circumstances, that telescope would only be good to, about 2,000 megacycles. Well, because they've made it out of 2,600 individual panels, and the panels have little actuator motors at the corners, and they've got a little corner tube cubes and a laser range-finding system at the focus, that dish can tune itself and increase its accuracy as a function of temperature, wind load, gravity, snow load, and everything else. And so that dish that normally would only be good to about 2,000 megacycles is good to 100,000 megacycles, 100 gigahertz instead of 2 gigahertz, because it is tunable. Every one of those 2,600 panels, a very neat engineering job that they did. I think it's something like 60 million pounds of rotating mass is this 310-foot diameter radio telescope. Really, I think it's the largest fully steerable radio telescope in the world. And so and that's open to the public. And most days of the week, you could go there and see that. And to some people's point of view, that's the eighth wonder of the world, if you know what I mean, particularly in the engineering world.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So you were lucky enough to see that beautiful radio telescope in Puerto Rico, which up until, it's still the largest radio telescope on planet Earth, but it's not fully steerable. You can only steer the feed horn in that one, plus or minus 15 degrees approximately. Whereas the one in Green Bank, West Virginia, a very quiet zone. That one is fully steerable across the whole darn sky, to my knowledge, or at least very far down to the horizon. And wider in frequency coverage, a little bit smaller in size than Arecibo, but the biggest fully steerable one. Okay, let's go over to John, and let's see what kind of questions we've had with the Mel's Corner, or it's now John's Corner, the mailbag. KC2WGB, the serious microwave voice of Staten Island. Let me think now. Why can't I think of the name of the county? Ah, Richmond. Richmond County. The microwave voice of Richmond County. One of the five boroughs of New York City. Go right ahead, John. I'm having some fun with you. KC2WGB. K2RAW in the Tech Man.
Hey, Dick. WS2N. I had a film for Steve. He asked about the Coast Guard radio equipment, the wattage, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, before he gets out of radio range, because I think he's mobile, go right ahead, Paul. Glad you popped in. Go ahead with that information. WS2N, K2RAW.
That was the same Steve. I recognize his voice, but I forgot to write his call letter down, but I think that's him. His question was, how many watts do the Coast Guard transmit? You know, is it 100, 150? What are they putting out, 200? You know, who knows what, right? So I got on with fellows in Connecticut, Shore Point Amateur Radio Club, a couple of guys there really familiar with all the scanning and this type of information, and they came up with a system that they use. It started about 8 years ago. It's called Rescue 21. If you Google that, you get a lot of information on what Rescue 21 is. It's a national project throughout the whole country. Started about 8 years ago, and they really started it about 4 years ago here. But before that, yeah, they ran 150 watts, big power, and you know they had a lot of different stations with single antennas hooked up to the radios. Then what they did with this Rescue 21 deal, let me drop it. Low power. But like, for instance, one station will have dozens of antennas hooked up to that one station, and you know, all out, all over everywhere, either linked by the internet or by another frequency, you know, between the antennas and the station, and they could tell where the call is coming from. So you know, it could be in trouble. Guy gets on channel 16, says, you know, got a problem, and right away they know now where he is. They kind of like use the different antennas receiving at one time, and they could figure out where this guy is relatively close, and you know, they could send a craft out. It's been done, you know, been done for many years now. Like I said, it started about 8 years ago. Let me drop it. Rescue 21 it is. You'll Google that, and you'll get all kinds of information on how they're doing this. All vertical antennas, I found out, they're not beams. And the power is, they don't post it. They don't post it, but one guy, M1ML, said, Bob, he says that he used to listen to these guys all the time. He'd hear the city from out Eastern Connecticut, and no more. You can't hear that. So he estimates they're running around 25 watts, no more than 50. And, you know, you...
KD2CMP, what a comment.
Going on, you can't hear it, but they can hear the individual stations that would be calling. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
KD2CMP, what a comment.
CMP recognized. Going to get to you in a second. Paul, I think you said they're not using beams, they're using pure vertical antennas, and maybe CMP is going to correct us on this, but when they are doing locating, are they locating on Coast Guard frequencies, Marine frequencies, or citizen band frequencies is question number one, and I presume their main reason of locating is to know, you know, where to send the rescue vehicles when somebody is hollering Mayday, and do you have an idea as to how they're doing that direction finding and locating? Do you happen to know that one? Over to you first, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
I ask that. It has to do with, you know, if you have different antennas set up in many miles, you know, in one area, and somebody's transmitting it, you're going to hear louder on this one and lower on that one. You know, in a sense, they're triangulating the this information. And, you know, you do that with a half a dozen antennas, and they say they know exactly where this calling station is. It also eliminates a lot of hoax calls. They do have a lot of problems with that. Back to you.
KZ2YDT with comment.
YDT recognized, and that you're after Bill. KZ2YDP. YDT. Boy, I'm having trouble writing down your call letters there, Matt. Okay, Bill, KD2CMP, being in West Babylon, I think is where you live. You probably have worked with the Coast Guard, and I bet you've got quite a bit of information, so tell us about it, Bill, how you think they're doing the direction finding and what kind of accuracy. KD2, Charlie Mike Papa, K2RIW on the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yeah, Dick, actually it goes back to my my Navy days. I was stationed at one of the Naval Security Groups on the East Coast in Virginia. And it goes back to the HFDF, you know, even though HF is different. It's antenna arrays, and it doesn't need high wattage. It's just a matter of a computer program, and if the array is set up the right way, they can tell where the strongest signal is coming from. It's pretty simple technology-wise, but very effective at the same point.
Yeah, give us a couple more words on that, Bill. You said an antenna array. Paul, WS2N, thought that the antennas were vertical-type antennas. If I put the right kind of array of vertical antennas together as a kind of a vertically polarized phased array, like put three of them together in a triangle or a square, and I've got the right kind of electronics between them, I can do a very good job of finding the direction of arrival of that signal at that particular, let's say, Coast Guard station. And if you've got another Coast Guard station a little bit further east or further west along the south shore of Long Island, for instance, and he also does his three triangular vertical antennas and gives a direction of arrival. And then by triangulating with those, you eventually, you know, the three lines of apparent azimuth will cross at some point in the Great South Bay or the Atlantic Ocean, and that's one way of direction finding. There's three or four major methods of direction finding. Right now we're talking about the angle of arrival detection by a phased array. And maybe that's what's being used, and I'm going to turn it back to you, Bill, for some further words if you think that's the way they're doing it. KD2CMP, K2RIW.
Now, my knowledge is a little dated, but the phased array, from what I understand, could be done with three. It could be done with as much as 12, and that would cover you for 360 degrees, depending on what your location is. If you had a 4 points, let's say on Long Island, and you had one phase in each of three antennas, it would be a very easy thing to find out, and that would cover you 360 degrees for X amount of miles.
Dick, this is not an array that I'm talking about. These are miles apart, each one of them.
Agree. What you're saying, Paul, is that the individual Coast Guard stations are miles apart, but now what Bill and I think are discussing is the nature of the antennas at each individual Coast Guard station that tries to find the direction of arrival of that emergency signal at that particular Coast Guard station. So you believe that they are simple vertical antennas. I'm wondering if there's more than one of them for that particular frequency range at that particular Coast Guard station. Over to you for a quick one on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Let me drop it. Well, first of all, it's all VHF, channel 16, their emergency frequency that they would use, that all the boaters would use. The antennas, each antenna, like you could have one station, say, in Bridgeport, and you might have an antenna 20 miles away, another one 15 miles away, another one 5 miles away. They're all linked to this one station, and you'll have another station somewhere else doing the same thing all the way up the sound all the way into the battery, you know, down the Hudson, all over, everywhere. That's what I'm saying, Dick. These antennas are miles apart, and then the information is being sent back to the Coast Guard station, who's talking to the guy that needs help at the time. It's so important, you know. They're all depending on cell phones. They think cell phones are good because they got GPS in them, but they're leading the person no problem. They don't even have to tell them where they are.
If the individual stations on VHF frequencies were miles apart, and if each individual antenna was a simple station master-like vertical collinear antenna, to get accurate direction finding out of that assembly of Coast Guard stations and antennas would be a little bit difficult. I think there's a little bit more to it. And I'm going to turn it over to Matt, and then I'm going to turn it back to Bill in that order to see if we've got some further information on this. KC2YDT, wonder what your experience with this is, Matt. K2LAW in the TechNet.
KC2YDT. Okay, the things I can offer you guys is to look on this particular website, AFRCC. It's Air Force Rescue Coordination Center. They handle all emergency EOTs and all that stuff. They would be the guys to ask of, you know, how exactly it works. And then they send it back over to, to the responsible agency, whether it be Coast Guard, whether it be, Inland Fire Department or something like that. But the Air Force Rescue Coordination Center, which is the number one in the country that it goes to. It's someplace down in Virginia where it actually gets transmitted to. And then it comes back, and so on. That's how the emergency locators work.
WJ2B with a comment. And KC2QIQ with a comment.
WJ2B recognized, and KC2QIQ. Okay. And I wonder, the Air Force Rescue Coordinated Center... Rescue Center, is that somehow tied in with Rescue 21? WJ2B, see what you've got to say on this one, sir. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, hello to everybody out there, WJ2B. I have a couple of comments. I'm not sure how this conversation even got started in what context, but as far as the Coast Guard in Long Island, I'm not sure what the rest of the country is doing, but I know that they are in the process of implementing the Rescue 21 system. And the way I know this, also from what I just heard here also, is that I've been in touch with the owners of Doppler Systems in Arizona. And basically, the Coast Guard decided around the year 2000 that they needed a better direction finding system than what they were using, and they decided to go with Doppler systems, and they outfitted pretty much all the major Coast Guard stations on the east coast and the west coast with Doppler systems equipment, which can do triangulation. And I actually saw the system in operation, the software part of it, at the Eden's Neck Coast Guard station about a couple of months ago at an open house. So they are still, anywhere on the East Coast, Long Island Sound, they're still using Doppler systems, Doppler array units, which have eight antennas up on a very high mast somewhere in the vicinity of the water. And they get bearing information off that antenna site, and then they triangulate it on a software map that shows you. I actually saw the map running on the guy's laptop screen on the EFX station. So they're still using Doppler systems. I don't think they've implemented the Rescue 21 around this area yet. Back over to you, Dick, WJ2B.
Very fine, Joe. That's some good information. The Doppler systems equipment with either 8 or 12, I'm not quite sure you said, antennas in a ring that does fairly accurate direction of arrival information. And then the various Coast Guard stations will use the bearing from the various stations, and therefore, it, in theory, it crosses at some particular point in, let's say, the Long Island Sound, if we're talking about the North Shore Coast Guard stations. Doppler Systems Equipment, that sounds like a brand name. Do you believe, Joe, that that is a Doppscan type? You know what the ham radio 4 or 6 antenna type Doppler scanner is called? Do you believe the 8 or 12 antennas are a more sophisticated version of a Doppler scanner? Do you think that's the way it is doing direction finding? WJ2B, K2RIW. Got it, Joe.
Yeah, Dick, WJ2B. It's exactly what it is. I actually own a surplus DDF 6000 from Doppler Systems that actually was sold on eBay. And the guy that was selling them on eBay acquired them from the Alameda, California Coast Guard station as surplus. They had about 30 of them, and they gave this surplus dealer about 10 or 12 of them to sell. So I actually own one that came from a Coast Guard station, and it could either do 8 or 4 antennas. You can hook it up depending on the antenna array. I'm using it with my Magrello antennas, which is 4, and I had to make a little interface box because they do a slightly different method to interface the antennas. It's not just a square wave going to the antenna. It's actually a triangle wave, so I had to convert that triangle to a square wave to be able to use it. So I was able to get the actual display unit with all the logic and the electronics that it has in it, but I could not get the antenna array. They weren't selling the base antenna, which would be the eight antennas, and there's also they make a mobile array that one of our bunny hunters actually bought from Doppler Systems. I don't know if you know Alan RFN. He actually has the mobile version, the model 5900, which has 4 antennas, which goes with magnet mounts on your roof. So Doppler Systems does make a base unit, which the Coast Guard purchased hundreds of them back in 2000. That was their biggest customer. And they also make a mobile version that law enforcement mostly use. It's very expensive, though. You're talking in thousands of dollars. And the Coast Guard, I think, still uses mostly the DDF 6000s with the triangulation software. So they get a transmission on channel 16. They get multiple sites triangulating, and they can tell exactly where the location of the transmission, if it's an emergency transmission, exactly where it's coming from. And I also saw the boats they had parked in the Coast Guard marina there. They actually have the
repeater. Time out. Time out. Cancel.
The last sentence that Joe said that got chopped out by the repeater is that he saw those actual antennas on top of the boats. You bought one of these surplus systems from the Alameda, California Coast Guard station. Is that because they, by mistake, bought too many of them, didn't need that many, or was it a system that maybe it's an early model number that they stopped using and using a later model number? What's your best guess as to how you were able to buy this rather new-sounding, expensive equipment on the surplus market, Joe? WJ2B, K2RIW.
Bill, what a comment.
It's actually been discontinued. The units that that the Coast Guard are actually using, they're still supported as far as repair. The current software still works with them, but they actually, the electronic units have been discontinued. So as far as I know, the Coast Guard is switching over to that Rescue 21 system, which is coming from, I believe, a company in Europe, from what I heard. I think it's Rohde & Schwarz. I'm not 100% sure, but they're multi-million dollars per installation from what I was told, whereas the Doppler Systems unit are only about maybe $10,000 to $12,000 per base installation. So it's quite an expensive proposition, the Rescue 21. So I don't believe they are in the process of switching over, but they haven't switched over everywhere to the Rescue 21. And I don't know if the Rescue 21 is just direction finding. I believe it's communications also. So, like you were saying, it has to do with power output and different communications gear also. Not only the not only the direction finding capability. And I think they're installing that in the boats also. So it's kind of a major undertaking, the Rescue 21. 21. So once they, you know, start switching more and more places over, you'll probably see more and more of these Doppler systems units showing up on eBay. Back over you, Dick, WJ2B.
Very good information, Bill. I mean, Joe. Bill recognized, and you're right behind Glenn, who chimed in a little bit earlier with a comment. Glenn, I know that you have done quite a bit of DOP scanning, some bunny hunting. I know that Alan has got a very nice system. Alan, by the way, Joe, do I know Alan, KC2RFN? He's the guy who filed the report that allowed the technical men to get that very nice national award of the ARRL about a year and a half or 2 years ago. So, yes, I certainly know Alan. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go right ahead with your comment. And I know that you've been refining a DOP scan system. I bet you've got it tuned up pretty well by now. KC2QIQ, K2RAW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, very good, Dick. I think Joe had pretty much covered everything I was going to say about, you know, what the Coast Guard used to use. And, you know, pretty much Doppler scanners. The Doppler systems, he gave a pretty good background on that. And, you know, the availability of a lot of this equipment now that's becoming surplus as they're moving since 2005 over to the Rescue 21 system. So my understanding is that they still have the capability of running the Doppler scanners with the Coast Guard, and they do use them, but I think the main system that they're getting implemented just about everywhere right now is the Rescue 21, and that will eventually, probably as the older Doppler scans die, or you know, just won't be replaced. I think after some period of time, but yeah, that generally is what the Coast Guard's doing for RDF. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
Glenn, are you also familiar with whether or not the Rescue 21 is possibly going to be manufactured by Rohde & Schwarz? Rohde & Schwarz is a German company, and from my point of view, it is the European equivalent of Hewlett-Packard. We think Hewlett-Packard is a Cadillac company in the United States for electronic equipment, and from my point of view, the equivalent in Germany is Rohde & Schwarz. The piece of equipment, the main network analyzer I use almost every day at my place of business, is made by RNS, and I'm very happy with it. It works like a charm. So over to you if you happen to know the answer to that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
It's supposed to be General Dynamics 6, WS2N.
Let me see if I've got it. Yeah, I believe the Rohde & Schwarz is supplying some of the equipment, Dick, but not the whole system. Rescue 21 is not like a simple Doppler system. It's a system that's being used across many of the, you know, since, you know, 2001, there was a directive with Homeland Security and many of the other organizations that do search, rescue, emergency type of operations, and this is a system that is also being adopted by the Coast Guard. So in other words, this is kind of like a nationwide home defense type of directional finding system, and the equipment, I think, as Paul has alluded to, is that, you know, it's being final assembled by General Dynamics, but at the same time, components are coming from a little bit of everybody, because it's a lot of it is really sort of off-the-shelf technology being used to put this Rescue 21 system together. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
So maybe RNS is supplying some of the equipment, and from what Paul just told us, I guess it's possible that General Dynamics is the prime contractor, and then his name is Bill. It's possibly QGZ, or maybe there's another Bill. Go right ahead, Bill. Give us your full call. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Mike Papa. Actually, I don't have much to add. I just wanted to refer to Joe, because Joe was describing the exact system that I was trying to describe earlier. Apparently, it was a 90s version. My experience was in the 80s, and later became Doppler. Okay, but it sounds like the same type of thing, and directional finding, and it's all good, and these gentlemen are up in... What is now was surplus was modern technology when I was involved.
good ham radio operator in the, was he in Southold or was he in Mauritius? I think he was in Mauritius. A man who was heavily involved with, in Southold, heavily involved with the Coast Guard. He's now a silent key, and I'm having trouble thinking of his call letters. But he was trying to help the Coast Guard come up with various direction-finding systems 10, 15 years ago, and it looks like Doppler scanning light. When you do enough web search on direction-finding systems, radio direction-finding systems, there's quite a few ways of doing it. Doppler scan is one. Trying to think of the name of the technique. Angle of arrival, in other words, a simultaneous angle of arrival. You have a whole bunch of antennas aimed in various directions, and you compare the signal strength between them. That's another system. Another system is a TDOA, time difference of arrival on multiple antennas, is another system. Phase-sensitive systems. The most accurate direction-finding system I worked on way back in, let me think now, the late 80s, was a system that was on, it now can be revealed that it was the main direction-finding system that was on the SR-71 airplane, and it could direction-find to the nearest approximately 1 degree in azimuth and elevation from an airborne platform. Really fancy system. It was called the double-dual interferometer. And so there's lots and lots of ways of doing direction-finding. Scanning antenna is one of them, a rotating antenna. Aiming a beam is another one. Doppler scan, time difference of arrival, amplitude, simultaneous amplitude comparison, and so on. So each of them have their pros and cons as to cost, accuracy, frequency, agility, and so on.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
But when it comes to a rescue operation, being able to locate the position to the nearest, let me pick a number, 100 yards, where the signal is coming from, to recognize right away that it is a real person with a real rescue requirement out in the water on, let's say, a sinking ship or a ship that's in trouble, no longer has a power plant that's operational, as opposed to somebody on land filing a phony report, knowing the locating, which is the next step beyond just direction finding, multiple direction finding, to really locate. And to locate with what's usually called an elliptical error of probability. In other words, when the system is working correct, you draw a series of contour ellipses on a chart, and so this is the ellipse being inside of which there's a 95% probability the signal is located, and inside of that is a smaller ellipse where there's a 50% probability, and so on. So some of the systems that have enough mathematics behind them start giving you that kind of analysis. Okay, this was all on Coast Guard direction finding. This was a little bit of a jump to another subject, back to a previous subject for previous week, and thank you for the information, Paul. Let's go back now to the mailbag, and John, try again. KC2WGB in the borough of Richmond, K2LAW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick, and everyone on the net. Yes, let me get my notes. I have a nice question from a young man, 13 years old. Name is Wolfgang Lunsman. I haven't heard that name on a young person in many years. He listens to us on a new scanner. He is going for his technicians in September, and his dad has promised to buy him one of those HTs, like a Wuxon, if he passes. And besides that, when he gets his general, his father told him he will buy him whatever Kenwood receiver he wants. Transceiver, I should say. So his question on this scanner, is he has a switch on the scanner which enables the squelch circuit. And one is RF carrier detection, the other one is speech. And he wants to know how the radio knows the difference between a carrier or a spoken word. So maybe you could give him a little bit of history on that. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Hmm. I'm not so sure. A smart guy knows something about what he doesn't know. I'm not so sure on this one. I can see ways that you could take a RSSI, in other words, some of the modern integrated circuit chips that have many of the individual stages built into them as a radio, RF front end, mixer, IF amplifier, final detection stage, and then maybe the beginning of audio amplifier. Some of these fancy radios on a chip have a pin coming out of it called RSSI, which stands for Receiver Signal Strength Indicator. So by using the RSSI on a scanner, as they come across a carrier that exceeds a certain threshold, sort of like a squelch threshold, I could fire a Schmidt trigger on the RSSI and say, stop scanning, and let's sit here for a while. A CW scanner could do that. And then, depending on what kind of modulation the signal has, if it's an amplitude modulation, then in theory, if the RSSI can respond fast enough during amplitude modulation, it will see, when the receiver is no longer scanning, it will see the indicated amplitude jumping up and down, and it can say, okay, that's an AM signal, we're going to stay here. And if it's within some period of time there is no amplitude modulation, then it would continue scanning and skip over that signal. That's a guess on my part. And if it was an FM modulated signal, I guess you could also enable a frequency discriminator on the tail end of the IF and look for audio coming out of the frequency discriminator, recognizing the fact that there's angular modulation taking place. But these are guesses on my part. I bet you there's somebody in the tri-state area who has a little bit more familiarity with modern-day scanners that can give us some more words on this, in which case I'd like to hear from you guys. Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW in the TechNet.
And so we are, Dick.
Rich recognized. By the way, I did hear somebody on, I think, EchoLink signing in. Sounded like K4ILK, and we'll get to you in a minute, sir. But Rich first, N2EO, go right ahead and tell us how these things work, Rich.
Okay, good evening, everybody. Yeah, it's very simple, Dick. The carrier stouch is like a carrier stouch on any FM or AM receiver. It looks for a signal, a carrier, RF. And you're basically right. The voice stouch, it's almost like a Vox circuit. It looks for modulation and opens the squelch when it sees any type of audio. The reason they do that, Dick, is because some signals, like take Limark, for instance, the carrier is always up on Limark, and if you wanted to keep scanning when it was just a dead carrier, it would hang up, and it would never scan. So they use the audio squelch, so as soon as the modulation goes to zero, even though there's a carrier, we'll scan to the next channel. Kind of handy, Dick. Back to that. N2EO.
WJTB to come.
Joe recognized. First, Rich, do you own one of these receivers that has this either carrier stop or audio stop? And what brand name is the one that you own that's got that function into it? Go ahead, Rich.
Up right now, Dick. I own one of the Radio Shack. Actually, I have two of the Radio Shack scanners that are packed up, made by GRE, General Radio. This is, it's not rocket science, Dick.
I hear you. And Joe, wonder if you own one of these. Wonder if you know something about how it works. WJ2B, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, WJ2B. The main reason, believe it or not, for the voice squelch and, you know, the modulation squelch, you know, exactly what he said is correct, that it's looking for audio. If there's no audio, it's just a dead carrier, it keeps going. And the main reason that they implemented that was to jump over birdies, because a lot of broadband receivers now are microprocessor controlled, and sooner or later, at such a wide range of frequencies, you're going to hit some multiple of some oscillator clock that's in the unit. You're going to get a birdie, and those birdies are usually just dead carriers, so that way they implemented the system. So you can skip the birdies and not be aggravated that it keeps stopping on birdies all the time. On WJ2B.
WJ2BHY with comment.
Okay. And I just suddenly realized that, Jim, I forgot you. Wow. Jim, back to you for a comment, and also you're allowed to give us your question. Sorry I kept you waiting. KD2BHY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
That's okay, Dick. I'll wait till after the mailbag. I think I'm going to, since I don't have anything to do tomorrow because school's out, I'm going to stay up a little late tonight listening for a while. But, is it, does it recognize, I mean, when, I think I have an idea maybe with FM. I mean, if it's just, if you're transmitting with FM and there's no audio, doesn't it not modulate at all? So wouldn't it recognize, the FM signal not modulating? I mean, I'm not sure. I'm not really positive. I mean, that's even what happens. But I mean, does it recognize only FM or AM? I'm not really sure.
I'm not sure either, Jim, but I'm going to make some guesses as to how it could be done. When you have a broad enough bandwidth on the IF strip of a particular receiver, and if it doesn't have a super sharp brick wall filter where the skirts are, you know, vertical and it's got a flat top across the top, when you plot frequency response versus frequency, let's call it amplitude response versus frequency of the filter, if you got a Gaussian-shaped filter and you tune a little bit high or a little bit low, an FM signal will be moving back and forth in frequency. It'll be walking up and down the skirt of the filter selectivity, and that's called slope detection. So an amplitude demodulated or envelope detecting receiver that's tuned a little bit high or low of the signal, that is FM modulated. For ILKR. That's too many letters to the... Oh, I guess it's repeater. Well, we're going to get to you in a second, sir. What I'm starting to say is slope detection is one way. However, a well-made receiver scanner these days has got both a AM detector and an FM detector, depending on which button you enable from the front panel. So I see the possibility of it detecting a signal, stopping the scan, looking at the audio output of the FM discriminator and the audio detector, looking at them simultaneously. And if either one has modulation, the AM detector has modulation, it says, that's a real signal, we'll sit here for a while. Or if the FM detector, the discriminator, which is in parallel, running at the same time, sees an audio signal, says, okay, we're going to stay here a while. And some of the birdies that you hear have got digital modulation on them, which could excite either one of them. And so some of the digital modulated birdies would give you a false alarm and the scanner would stop on it, and maybe that's not desirable. And other ways that you could differentiate between human speech and digital, I think there are techniques that you could program into the system so it only scans the ones that you really want to listen to. So these are some of my guesses as to how it could be done. I'm hearing a person signing in by EchoLink, I think it is, called K4ILKR. Let's find out who that is. Please start off with your name, sir, and your comment. K for ILK, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yeah, Roger, KJ4ILK. Your name here is Ricky. I've checked in here a few times before. I'm in Chatsworth, Georgia. My take on this is in order for it to even receive anything, there has to be a signal present. And it has to be strong enough to actually make the tuner think that it would have to amplify that. If it's not strong enough, it will keep it closed and keep going. Unless you open up the squelch, which in that case, then it would start receiving the weak signals that it would normally block out. The other thing you just mentioned is, on the scanner I have, I have to get the catalog out, because I haven't looked at the model number in quite some time, but mine, I have a program where it has all analog, or standard as I call it, and all synthesized, or all digital voices, and I can program it where it scans either just the analog or just the synthesized, Moto Turbo or Trunked or something like that. Back to you, Evan. KJ4ILK in the TechNet.
KJ4, ILK, Jim recognized, but let me go back to Richie first. Very interesting. If you can programming it for Moto Turbo and stop on a Moto Turbo signal, I'm kind of amazed because my understanding of Moto Turbo is that it is a kind of secure digital system. Are you able to get audio out of a Moto Turbo signal? And maybe Moto Turbo has got multiple modes of operation, some of which are secure and some of which are not secure. So give us a few words on that one, Richie. KJ4ILK from Georgia, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, QSL, and hello to, I call him Gary, I know that's not his name, but, yeah, I haven't heard you in a while. Well, see, I used to be on this forum, and I heard about it, so what I did was program the local frequency that uses it around here, and basically it's just a trunked system that uses, I'm going to say, type 2 along with digital coded scopes. So you have your, I want to say, 131.8 data stream going out from the digital coded scopes, and then you also have your voice encryption going out as well as that onto the trunk system. So when it comes through, it makes a beep, and then it sounds like, if you've ever listened to music with vocoder, it sounds kind of like that.
So I think you're saying that if you program it to stop on a Moto Turbo signal, that it not only will stop on that, but you actually get synthesized speech out of it. And as I said, I'm a little bit amazed by that because I thought one of the purposes of the Moto Turbo was a kind of secure audio. But maybe it has a secure mode and a non-secure mode. So maybe you're listening to non-secure mode Moto Turbo audio. That's a guess on my part. And so you can give me a confirmation on that one, Richie. KJ4ILK, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger. That's affirmative there. Now, I have to, by the way, just to let you know, I am looking into that. From what I've seen, you are correct. There is a regular trunking mode. There's three modes. There's analog, there's Moto Turbo Secure, then there's Moto Turbo Unsecure for the older trunking systems. So that radio, I think, is a 4550, is what one of the test modulations was coming from. Over.
Okay, thank you for that information, Richie. I turned down one of these audios here. Jim, I know you had some further questions. KD4BHY, K2LIW. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, Dick, I just wanted to ask about this this thing on the scanner. Do you think it would recognize other modes like SSD or other modes not like FM or AM?
Yeah, stopping on a scanner to stop on single sideband, I think, could be a little bit troublesome because a well-tuned single sideband receiver where the carrier null is set properly puts out essentially zero power when you're not speaking into the microphone. And then just the audio that you speak into the microphone makes it put out an RF envelope that's single sideband modulated. So to stop on a single sideband signal would be a little bit troublesome. You would have a probability of intercept. You could stop on it when the guy is talking, and then if he paused for a while and you scan through that, you wouldn't find him. Or if you stopped on him and then he stopped and didn't talk for a while, your receiver would, your scanner would possibly proceed on and leave that frequency, if you know what I mean. So sideband is a troublesome signal. I know my point of view on single sideband, on the case of the 432 band or the 10 gigahertz band, lining up on a single sideband signal by waving the antenna back and forth in azimuth for me was very difficult until I developed a particular technique for doing it, and that is when your receiver is operating in the normal mode, let me drop, and the automatic gain control system, automatic volume control, automatic gain control, is doing its thing, whether the guy is a strong signal or a weak signal on single sideband, within reason, what you hear out of the earphones or out of the loudspeaker sounds the same. I mean, as you start aiming the antenna toward that source of signal, and the signal is getting stronger, the automatic gain control cuts back the gain greater and greater amounts, therefore you hear no difference in the audio coming out, and you don't know when the antenna is aimed correctly. Yeah, you can sort of do it by watching the signal strength indicator, but the signal strength indicator is bouncing all over the place as the guy talks. What I discovered that works for me is to turn the RF gain control on the receiver down very low so that there is essentially no automatic gain control operation. And I'm just using the sound I hear in the earphones and the memory characteristics of a human brain. The human brain very easily can figure out speech as a guy talks in a single sideband transmitter. Now, as I wave the antenna back and forth in azimuth by using my antenna rotator, and my memory of how strong the speech sounded on its peaks as I wave the antenna across his particular direction of arrival, I can very rapidly find out where to peak the antenna, if you know what I mean. And then once I peak the antenna, I set the receiver back into the normal mode, turn the RF gain back up. So that's how it has worked for me, to program a scanner to do that. I think you could do it, and are the currently available scanners capable of stopping on a single sideband station? Since Rich N2EO is one of the guys who has used a number of these scanners, I'm going to ask him. I'll bet you it would be a little bit difficult to force a scanner to stop on a sideband station reliably. That's my guess. Let's see what Rich has done along those lines. N2EO.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, I think you're correct. It probably could be done. Anything can be done, but generally you want to receive sideband, then you use a communications receiver, like one of the classics is the R7000 by ICOM. That would be more apropos to do sideband. Not one of these scanners. They do FM, AM, and that's pretty much it. Trunking. Pretty much it. I'm not an expert on this, believe me.
Yeah, sideband has a number of problems when it comes to scanning. Another thing that sideband has, you have to recognize the fact that the RF output of the transmitter goes to zero when you pause and you're not putting any speech into the microphone. Many of us will buy from a place like, for instance, Advanced Receiver Research, a low noise preamplifier that is RF keyed, RF switched, and you put that in front of a ordinary receiver, and the presence of the low noise amplifier will drastically increase the sensitivity of reception. And because you bought the right one that automatically RF switches, when you go back and transmit with the transceiver, the low noise amplifier recognizes the fact that RF energy is coming back into its back end from the transceiver, and it automatically flips to the transmit mode. It flips its relay, internal relay, into the bypass mode, and now your transmitter output is going through that bypass relay and going straight to the antenna. And then when you stop talking, it flips back to the receive mode. Well, the problem with that RF switching is that now this relay is clicking back and forth on each one of the pauses of your speech. And you could, if you want to, adjust the time constant of that circuit so that each time it gets an RF signal and goes to the bypass mode, that it hangs there for 1 or 2 seconds, and therefore as long as you don't pause for more than 1 or 2 seconds, it stays in the transmit mode. And you can sort of live with it that way, but now the next problem is that when you stop talking, for the next 2 seconds or so, it's going to hang in the transmit mode, and you're not going to hear the guy that wants to start talking back to you. And so the first couple of words he says are being missed. Therefore, whenever I've had a preamplifier in line of my transceiver, I have always rewired it in such a way, let me drop, so that it is what I call hard keyed. In other words, the push to talk button on the microphone that enables the sideband transmitter, I force that to demand that the low noise preamplifier be in the bypass mode while I push that button, and therefore when I stop pushing the button, it immediately, with no time constant, goes right back to the receive mode, and I'm hearing full sensitivity. So when you have one of these preamplifiers and you've hard-keyed it, they're very pleasant to use. But when it is RF-keyed, it's very unpleasant to use. The guy that you're talking to also has a problem in that every time you start talking into the mic, because it has a certain attack time before the preamplifier goes into its bypass mode, the guy is always going to miss the first syllable of each word when you start talking, if you know what I mean. So many of these afterburner amplifiers or RF preamplifiers really should be hard-keyed. To leave it in the RF keyed mode, except for a temporary operation, I don't recommend that. It's kind of unpleasant to listen to. I know this is off the side of the original question that that Wolfgang asked us, John, but some people enjoy this other information. And if we haven't covered portions of his question, please tell me about that, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
And so we have, Dick.
Stand by, John. Go ahead, Rich.
Now, I've got preamps on 2 meters, 432, and 1296 that are hard keyed. One thing you're forgetting, Dick, well, maybe you're not forgetting.
November 2, November Yankee Whiskey listening, Brooklyn, New York.
I have a sequencing box that I bought from Down East Microwaves, because a lot of these preamps can't take power if they're hot switched. In other words, if the relay complex is seeing RF at the time it switches, not a good thing. So what I've got set up here, when I hit the push to talk, the first thing that happens before the transmitter comes on, the preamp switches into the transmit mode, then, let's see, then the amplifiers switch into the transmit mode, and the last thing that happens is the transmitter comes on. And it goes through the reverse procedure, going back to the sieve. So the contacts of all the relays never switch hot. Back to net, N2EO.
Ed recognized, and Ed, I'm going to go over to you in a second, and that's a very good point. The microwave operators have got a real problem on this one. If you've got a remotely operated 10 gigahertz transmitter on top of the tower behind the 2-foot dish, as the way I did it, where all of the transceiving is done with, in my case, a 200 milliwatt solid state transmitter in a box behind the dish, and I feed 144 megacycles up to it. It converts it to 10.368 by a mixer assembly, and there's a low noise preamplifier in there. And the low noise preamplifier cannot even tolerate the 200 milliwatts. It would blow it out. So you have to make sure that you have what's called differential keying. In other words, when you go to the transmit mode, just like Rich was indicating to us, the relay in the bypass mode flips first. If it's an extremely safe system, there's some kind of a confirmation set of contacts on that relay telling you that not only the relay has closed into the transmit mode, but has that chance to stop bouncing, if you know what I mean, then the transmitter is enabled for the first time. And when you go back from transmit to the receive mode, the first thing that happens is the transmitter is killed. Then the command is given for flipping the relay. Because when an electromechanical relay is in transition, when its little armature is halfway between the transmit mode and the receive mode contact to a microwave signal, that's a significant amount of capacitive coupling between what you think is an open circuit, your ohm meter during the transition, you know, an oscilloscope used as an ohm meter, and you can rapidly see what's going on. You would think there's a pure open circuit there. RF-wise, you're in no man's land. You're halfway between transmit and receive. You're capacitively coupled between the two, and depending on the power of your transmitter, it's capable of destroying your valuable low-noise front-end transistor, that beautiful gas FET you've got in there.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So if you're a real smart guy using any kind of a afterburner amplifier and or with preamplifier, you will align things with differential keying. You'll have a specifically designed circuit that does the timing of transmitter enable, transmitter de-enable, command to the relay to go to the transmit mode or go to the receive mode. All of that timing has to be done just right so that you don't see great big delay times and so you don't transitional periods of time in which power is being applied to your valuable preamplifier or and so on. So to do it right really requires some careful doing. Let's see what Ed's got to say on this. N2, November Yankee Whiskey, K2RIW. You got it, Ed. I'm pretty sure I did hear N2, NYW, Ed in Brooklyn. Are you still there, Ed? Okay, maybe he was just testing a transmitter. Alrighty. Back to you, John. I know we got pretty far left of center of the original scanner question.